Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, November 29th, 2016.
We are going to fix our inner cities
and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals.
But you look at our tunnels, they're disgusting, they're dirty, they're soot, the tiles are all off, the roads are in bad shape. You know, as a builder, it's disgusting to me. You go through these tunnels, I like tippy-top. I like everybody goes to my buildings and my clubs, they're tippy-top.
The American Infrastructure Act leverages public-private partnerships and private investments through tax incentives to spur $1 trillion in infrastructure investment over the next 10 years.
When we fix the infrastructure of our country, I want that to be under budget.
If our bridges and tunnels were beautiful and new and fresh.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. So fresh and new, Donald Trump says he's got $1 trillion in store for tunnels and bridges and roads and water. It's the kind of talk that makes Democrats absolutely salivate. They've been gunning for big spending on infrastructure for years, and it was even a silver lining for a lot of Dems after Mr. Trump's victory in the presidential election. Well, today, Donald Trump announced former Labor Secretary Elaine Chao as his choice to be Transportation Secretary. She served under President George W. Bush. Now, Chao also served as Deputy Secretary of Transportation under President George H.W. Bush. And if you're wondering how hard a time Chao might have getting confirmed by this GOP Senate, Elaine Chao happens to be married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Well, if she is confirmed by the Senate, she'll be in a key position to implement Trump's infrastructure plan. The Dems have been cautiously approaching the president-elect's outstretched hand ever since Election Day, wondering if there might be some billions for public works in there. But one top Democrat advisor says this is not FDR and Trump's infrastructure plan is not what Democrats have been dreaming of. Everyone who watched the populist rise of blue-collar voters wants to find a way to deliver and put those people to work. But Ronald Klain is loudly telling Democrats, don't fall for it, no matter how tippy-top the pitch from Donald Trump is.
Tippy-top!
Klain was an assistant to President Obama. He helped oversee the 2009 stimulus, and he was an advisor to Hillary Clinton's campaign as well. Ron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if there is hope for a common agreement here. I mean, why do both Democrats and Donald Trump want a giant infrastructure project, plan, whatever form it takes, so badly? I mean, of course, infrastructure is in need of repair. Everyone has a stake in all 50 states. But what we're talking about here is the potential for employment for millions of underemployed blue-collar workers without a college degree, right? And the opportunity to fill a big hole at the nexus of our economy and our politics that really helped drive this last election in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
Well, look, I don't know what Donald Trump wants. What I know is what he's proposed, which isn't really an infrastructure plan. It's a tax cut plan for wealthy investors. I know that Democrats believe firmly that we need a big infrastructure program like the one Secretary Clinton put forward in the 2016 campaign for both the reasons you talk about, Todd. On the one hand, we do have crumbling infrastructure in a lot of areas and certainly need to maintain and improve our infrastructure to keep our competitiveness as a country. How much time it takes, how complicated it is to move goods to market, to move people to their jobs. All these things have a big economic impact, and great infrastructure makes our country more efficient and more successful. And then, of course, there are jobs created when you go to build these things. I think we need to be careful not to overclaim how many jobs are created. A lot of infrastructure projects now use a lot of machinery. They are very sophisticated in how they schedule workers. They may not create as many jobs as in the past, but they do create jobs. They are generally good-paying jobs, and they're jobs, as I said, that adds to our overall productivity and success as a country. So if we had a real infrastructure plan on the table that really addressed our national needs, I think that would be something that Democrats would support, something we've proposed time and again, something that we put in the Recovery Act in 2009 when President Obama was trying to get us out of the recession. It's something he proposed additional versions of throughout his presidency. So it's definitely a need, but it's got to be done the right way. If it's done the wrong way, you wind up not really solving our needs, spending a lot of taxpayer money, making some big construction industry investors quite rich, but not really creating jobs and not really fixing our problems.
So despite the losses in this election, Ronald Klain, Democrats do have some power here. What you're doing is appealing to the 48 or so Democratic senators who have the filibuster power here on any big infrastructure plan that comes their way. What have you been telling them about what they should try to win as concessions in this negotiation that Paul Ryan would agree to over on the other side of the Capitol and that ultimately Donald Trump might sign?
So I think Democrats, you know, we are a minority in the House and the Senate, but a majority in the country. And we are the opposition, but not really the minority party. And so I think they need to focus less on what Paul Ryan will agree to, what Donald Trump will sign, and more on what they stand for. What are our core beliefs as a party? What are we fighting for? What are we standing up for and speaking out for? And I think here the answer should be clear. We should be speaking out for really addressing the national needs of water systems like the ones in Flint, Michigan, but all around the country that need upgrades, roads that really need to be first class, bridges that are in repair. We need to be speaking up to those needs, doing that in a way that creates real jobs for working people and that doesn't undercut our labor and environmental protections. I think if we stand up and speak out and fight for those things, we'll have the country behind us and the Republicans will have to go along. I think the most important thing for Democrats is to remain true to our principles and to really fight for real change that will really help people.
Ronald A. Klain is busy trying to rally Democratic troops to stand and fight when it comes to infrastructure and a plan that Donald Trump may put forward to Congress once he takes the oath of office. Ronald Klain was an assistant to President Obama and also an advisor to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
President-elect Donald Trump has picked Republican Georgia Representative Tom Price as his choice to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, Price is an orthopedic surgeon well-versed in Medicare and health insurance. If confirmed by the Senate, Price will have an annual budget at HHS of $1 trillion and would be in a position to help dismantle one of President Obama's signature achievements. Of course, that's the Affordable Care Act. Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the next Democratic leader of the Senate, called Price out of the mainstream and said that putting him in charge of health care was like asking the fox to guard the hen house. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Mary Agnes.
Hi there.
So Tom Price is a conservative. He's a former chairman of the Budget Committee. He's a healthcare warrior. What do you get with Tom Price if he's HHS secretary?
You get a strong opponent of the Affordable Care Act. You get someone who's really in lockstep with Republican leadership on ideas to repeal the law. You would see massive changes under the Affordable Care Act, or if they repealed and replaced it, things like high-risk pools, health savings accounts, those tax-deferred accounts for healthcare expenses. You'd probably have some age-adjusted tax credits. So instead of giving people money based on income, as the Affordable Care Act does to buy healthcare, you would do it for age and older people getting more money. You might see block granting of the Medicaid program, that shared federal-state program for the poor and disabled. You might even see some changes to Medicare, moving Medicare to this idea of premium support, where individuals get a certain amount of money to purchase coverage under the program.
So Tom Price has been a healthcare warrior, as I mentioned, and he's been somewhat technocratic. You know, I saw an interesting little bit of a statement from Senator Alexander from Tennessee, who's a kind of technocratically minded Republican. He said, "I look forward to working with Tom Price to find a responsible way to replace and then repeal Obamacare." And Mary Agnes, you might interpret that as an establishment Republican saying, "Don't bring slash and burn over here. We have to move slowly and carefully when it comes to dismantling Obamacare."
No, and I think that you may find more Republicans on that page, because it might give a lot of Republicans pause, this idea of repealing it without a replacement, or repealing it and saying, we'll get something ready to go in the next year or two. I think that is really the difficult question here for Republicans, because as we know, there's more than 20 million people who've gotten health care coverage based on the Affordable Care Act. And that's 20 million lives that you are responsible for if you repeal this law. So I think this sort of go slow idea that you just mentioned may definitely especially gain steam in the Senate as they are faced with actually voting on something that could get signed by President-elect Trump and put into law.
Obamacare and Medicare are huge issues, of course. You know, when you're HHS Secretary, Mary Agnes Carey, there's a lot of ideological opportunities as well. Where does Tom Price come down? How is he likely to act on issues like women's health, contraception, even abortion, that will definitely come up if he's secretary?
Well, he's definitely been a social conservative on those issues. He's voted against federal funding of abortion, voted against funding for groups like Planned Parenthood, and any kind of thing like parental leave for federal employees, or that he voted against a law that now requires FDA to regulate tobacco as a drug. So I think, again, he will stay true to his roots, where he has been in six terms in Congress, solid conservative Republican on some of these social issues and on healthcare. And the question is really for the party, how do they want to navigate? As we both know, the House has voted dozens of times, I think more than 60 times, to repeal all or part of the Affordable Care Act. Well, now they have a decision to make. Do they want to try to craft something that could theoretically in some way possibly get bipartisan support, which would make implementation of it easier? Do they want to stick to what the base wants, a full repeal with a very, very market-focused approach? We'll just have to wait and see.
All right, Mary Agnes Carey, thank you so much. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The United States Supreme Court ruled back in 2002 that the execution of individuals with intellectual disabilities violated the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. But that wasn't the final word, because the court also turned around and left it to the states to decide who is intellectually disabled and who isn't. Well, today the Supreme Court returns to the question of intellectual disability in the case of Moore v. Texas. The court's going to decide if the state of Texas has used unfair mental health criteria to sentence Bobby Moore to die. Bobby Moore has been on death row since 1980. Jordan Stryker is professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin and director of the Capital Punishment Center there. Jordan Stryker, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
As I said, the court already ruled back in 2002 that executing a mentally disabled person violates the Constitution, the Eighth Amendment. Why is Mr. Moore's case at issue here?
Well, even though the Supreme Court held that persons with intellectual disability are exempt from the death penalty, almost from the beginning, Texas has resisted that decision. The Supreme Court's decision did not give states the right to decide a new substantive definition of intellectual disability. It gave states some latitude in terms of structuring the procedures for making the determination, but Texas has come up with its own ad hoc, improvised, anti-clinical approach to intellectual disability, which has created enormous problems in Texas.
Now, you called it an anti-intellectual approach. It's been criticized as not adhering to medical or psychologically accepted criteria for establishing whether Mr. Moore and others are in fact intellectually disabled. But there's a really odd sort of twist in this case that actually has to do with the John Steinbeck novel of Mice and Men. Can you explain?
Well, after the Supreme Court made its decision that persons with intellectual disability should be exempt from execution, the Texas court said, we don't really think that all people who meet traditional clinical criteria should be exempt. The court said, we think the exemption should be reserved for folks like the fictional character Lenny from Of Mice and Men. And of course, in that novel, Lenny didn't understand at all that he was hurting other people. Lenny is sort of the archetype of the very severely impaired person and doesn't really correspond to the class of people that the Supreme Court intended to exempt.
So Lenny is also a fictional character. There has been this idea, as I understand it, in the scientific community and even in the legal community, that intellectual disability for this purpose hovers somewhere around a 70 IQ. Does Texas have here what can be called a medically or scientifically valid standard, whether they use Lenny or not, of getting to that mark that other states have accepted?
No, Texas is pretty much on board with the IQ requirement. And in this case, it's pretty clear that Mr. Moore meets the significantly sub-average intellectual functioning that's reflected in a low IQ. The debate has really focused on what kinds of adaptive deficits an individual has to have in order to satisfy the definition. And Texas has come up with its own almost unprecedented criteria for gauging adaptive deficits, things like whether or not the individual is capable of lying, as though persons with intellectual disability would simply not have that ability, or whether or not a person can react coherently to questions, which again is a caricature. The Texas has really created a caricature of what persons with intellectual disability look like, and really is focusing on people with moderate or severe intellectual disability rather than all of the folks who fall within the bottom 3% of intellectual functioning.
So there are two parts here, I suppose, when the court eventually rules on this case. I mean, there is the narrow issue, really, of whether Bobby Moore lives or dies, according to how the court rules. And then, of course, there's the broader issue of whether the Texas standard is a constitutionally accepted standard and other states might follow suit.
I actually don't think other states will follow suit. Texas has really gone its own way in crafting this test and in invoking the fictional character Lenny. Texas has had a history of sort of defying Supreme Court constitutional protections in capital cases, and I really think this is about the Supreme Court correcting the Texas approach rather than it fearing that the Texas approach is going to spread to other jurisdictions.
Where are the likely votes here in the court? Is there a chance for a 4-4 deadlock? And if so, what would that mean for Mr. Moore?
Well, when you have eight justices, there's always a chance for a 4-4 deadlock. And it's hard to predict how the court is going to decide cases like this. And if the court did deadlock, that would be bad news for Mr. Moore. And it would be bad news for the folks on Texas's death row with intellectual disability.
Do we have any sense from prior rulings, from prior approaches to the issue of intellectual disability, where this court might land?
I think we do. The Supreme Court recently held in a Florida case that Florida could not defy conventional clinical criteria in deciding who counts as intellectually disabled for the exemption. And so the Supreme Court has been enforcing the decision that it made in 2002. And I think that it rarely takes court cases like this unless it wants to correct what the state court has done. And I think the signs are quite clear that the court is concerned with Texas's overzealousness in defying the Atkins decision.
The case of Moore v. Texas goes before the Supreme Court today. At issue, rules in Texas that define, in perhaps a capricious way, who qualifies as intellectually disabled when it comes to the death penalty. And it might be a good time to reread Of Mice and Men. Jordan Stryker, professor of law at University of Texas at Austin, director of the Capital Punishment Center. Thanks for your time, sir.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And if you thought the election was over, turns out there are still a couple of stones left unturned in the Midwestern part of this country. On Monday, the Michigan Board of Canvassers certified Donald Trump's victory in Michigan, and that paves the way for the Green Party candidate for president, Jill Stein, to request a recount in Michigan by the deadline on Wednesday. Now, Stein has already officially requested recounts in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania as well. President-elect Donald Trump won the state of Michigan on November 8th by 10,704 votes across 83 counties. Now, you'll remember that Trump spent the election telling Americans that it was rigged against him. Then on Sunday, he falsely told the nation that millions of people voted illegally. But in response to this recount, he said the Green Party scam to fill up their coffers by asking for impossible recounts is now being joined by the badly defeated and demoralized Dems. The Democrats are now officially involved with the Clinton campaign, agreeing to back the recount effort. Brandon Dillon is chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Brandon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So how does this begin for a recount of 4.8 million ballots? It's done by hand in Michigan. You have paper ballots. What's your role? What do you guys do now? Are you staring at Chads with magnifying glasses like we saw in Florida so many years ago?
Because the recount is expected to be initiated by Jill Stein, the Clinton campaign has indicated that they will be participating in that. At this point, at the state party level, we have not been asked to provide any resources specifically towards that, but we expect that that may happen. And the good news is we'll be able to recruit people to help and be able to participate in that as well when called to do so. But really, there is a process that this goes on. I think the Board of Elections has indicated that the 19 largest counties in Michigan would go first. Those would be hand-counted by the Board of Canvassers in those counties with representatives from the folks asking for the recount, and then the Trump campaign, two each, could be there to observe and make sure that everything is done correctly.
Okay. You know, Brandon Phillips, you know, we all watched the campaign, and you heard me at the top here describe how Donald Trump ran for president, calling the election rigged. You know, it was your candidate who repeatedly said that instilling a sense of you know, unfairness in the election was un-American and undermining democracy. Everybody believes in fair elections, but I wonder if you risk some hypocrisy here yourself. I mean, I know this is Jill Stein's recount, but Democrats at large risk some hypocrisy here themselves by going back and counting ballots again and having a recount in an election where at the time nobody suggested irregularities in Michigan or Wisconsin.
Well, I think it's important to note that this is not a recount that's been requested by either the Clinton campaign or by anybody associated with the Michigan Democratic Party. The Clinton campaign has been very clear. Mark Elias, their attorney, has said that they've looked at this, and the reason they didn't file any request for a recount is they didn't see enough evidence to suggest that there was any large-scale irregularities. Now, the fact that somebody else has come in and is willing to spend the money to do that, I think there's an obligation to make sure that we participate and assist. We don't expect the result to change significantly. I think that's been clear from day one. We understand that the election system in Michigan has got a record of being very accurate. Most recounts at the local level don't significantly change the number on election night, but you know, now that the recount is likely to be requested, we want to make sure that we do everything possible to ensure that it's done fairly and that all votes are counted the way that voters intended their votes to be cast.
Still, we should say 10,000 votes, which was the margin out of 4.8 million, that's 0.2%. I mean, that's close. Maybe you don't
expect
it.
It's very close.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very close. The optical scan machines actually have a very high rate of success, so to speak. They're very accurate. We've seen that in local recounts where the numbers per precinct usually don't sway very much, if at all.
Brandon Dillon, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
President Obama and Vice President Biden will not attend the funeral for Fidel Castro scheduled for December 4th. That's according to reports from the White House this week. We want to continue our own look at Fidel Castro's impact and legacy. Today, we turn to someone whose early life was shaped by the late ruler from a very young age. Carlos Ayer left Cuba in 1962 at the age of 11 without his parents. He was one of 14,000 Cuban children airlifted by the U.S. by Operation Peter Pan. Well, that young Carlos Ayer is now Professor Carlos Ayer at Yale University and author of Waiting for Snow in Havana. Ayer has written about two Castros, this idea of a wide gulf in how people view Fidel Castro. To some, he's the revolutionary, the defier of imperialism. And to others, like Carlos Ayer, Castro's the monster, the despot. And he says the split comes from the fact that dictators on the left get a pass while dictators on the right don't.
Fidel Castro has killed and tortured and imprisoned 100,000 people more than Augusto Pinochet ever did. And yet Fidel gets a pass and he gets all these obituaries from other world leaders, especially the most nauseating of all, Justin Trudeau, praising him for what he's done. He ruined his country. He impoverished his people. He's responsible for so many human rights abuses that they're probably impossible to count.
And yet in his life, it seems now that Fidel Castro passes from the scene almost with a sigh. I mean, he left power 10 years ago, a country in economic trouble, and now normalizing with the U.S. with no real drastic changes to the political situation that Fidel Castro wanted when it comes to the United States. His brother, Raul, is to leave next year. It almost seems like in his own life, Fidel Castro leaves not with a bang, but a whimper.
Oh, a definite whimper. He's been a ghostly figure for the past 10 years. And some medical experts who have watched his behavior the few times that he was in public think that he had a stroke during one of his surgeries, and that this is one of the reasons that he appeared in public so infrequently. But yeah, he lost control 10 years ago. And Raul has, much to my surprise, because the man has absolutely no charisma, Raul has held on to the throne. And it's quite likely if he does step down, which I don't think he will do in 18, that it will be Raul's son who will ascend to the throne. It's a dynastic family.
So you don't expect the succession plan that's in place now that has government bureaucrats stepping in is likely to take place?
No, I do not, because you can't trust anything that they broadcast. There have been so many appointed successors in the past. I've lost count of that, too. And none of them have ever slipped into the slot that they were supposed to fill. As a matter of fact, they've all disappeared in one way or another. One of them was actually charged with drug trafficking and shot. So, no, I don't expect this kind of storefront dummy they now have as the designated successor to take over. It's the military who are in control. It's a military junta. They're not going to have a non-military person in charge.
So, Carlos Herrera, it doesn't sound like you have a great deal of hope or expectation for big changes in Cuba's immediate future. Despite Fidel Castro's death, there is a new relationship between the United States and Cuba. That is a big change. Do you have any idea that Cuba could be fundamentally different in 5 years than it is now?
No, it won't be. We have yet to see what the new President Trump is going to do with President Obama's executive orders regarding Cuba, because most of the change in U.S.-Cuba policy has been through executive orders. And it will be very easy with the stroke of a pen for Trump to undo all that. So we have to wait and see what happens in the next few months. But even if he undoes all that, it's not going to change anything on the island, except it'll just become poorer and poorer because Venezuela is collapsing. And without Venezuela's free oil and other aid, all that's left to them is tourism and the remittances sent by Cuban exiles to their families, which last year Cuba was visited by 3 million tourists. This year they're expecting 4 million. And this is an island with only 11 million. And the remittances from exiles last year were also a low billion figure. That will be their only source of income because they produce nothing anymore. Half of the arable land is not being used for anything.
So, Carlos Herrera, what has this been like for you personally? Mm-hmm. We've talked about a lot of the politics. We've talked about your feelings about Fidel Castro, of course. Do you feel any sense of relief now at all that the man is gone? What's it like for you?
No, I don't feel any relief. This came way too late, 60 years too late, as a matter of fact. The man was a sociopath. He should have never been taken control of the country, but that's what some sociopaths are very good at doing, like Hitler and Stalin. So he's gone, but he's been gone for 10 years, and the system is still in place. What disturbs me the most is hearing anyone praise him for anything. And for some reason, the pass that he gets and the little trophies awarded to him for being such a great human being, for me, are completely beyond comprehension. I've had family members imprisoned, tortured, executed. The Cuban government prevented my father from leaving. The last time I saw him was when I was 11 years old. But I know also hundreds of thousands of other families in the same situation. And he ruined Cuba. He ruined it completely. Anyone who goes there now marvels at the architecture, which they can see beyond all the crumbling. They can see that once it was beautiful. Nothing new has been built except for the apartheid hotels where foreign tourists get to enjoy themselves on the beach and Cubans wait on them. That's all. That's all the country has become, a labyrinth of ruins, thanks to his guidance.
And now there is some change of some kind coming to Cuba for sure, not only the death of Fidel Castro and the leaving of power possibly of his brother Raul, but as you said, a new American president, Donald Trump. And I wonder, Carlos Heyer, if you can imagine a time in the future where a symbol of America in Cuba would be one of those hotels on the beach with Trump emblazoned across the top, and what that might
be. It's crossed my mind, and I wouldn't put it past the Castro regime to also give an okay to casinos. I know that's next. That's next in their money-making scheme. I'm sure that they'll return to the casinos. Look, they've already returned to tourism, which Fidel Castro condemned in 1959. He didn't want Cubans waiting on anyone else. He condemned prostitution. Well, that returned. Tourism returned. And what's next? Well, casinos. Why not? So I don't believe anything Trump says. He has promised to turn back Obama's executive orders, but it remains to be seen. Quite often, I've noticed, says one thing, promises one thing, and does something different. It wouldn't surprise me, let me put it that way.
Carlos Heyer, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Carlos Heyer is professor at Yale University. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Reformations, The Early Modern World. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. Jury selection is underway in the federal case against Dylann Roof, who is standing trial for the murder of 9 parishioners at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina last year. Roof is a self-proclaimed white supremacist, and he allegedly opened fire on the Bible study group there after sitting with them at their weekly meeting. Roof is charged with 33 federal counts, including murder, civil rights violations, and hate crimes. If he's convicted, he faces the possibility of execution here. The jury selection process was delayed earlier this month after attorneys for Roof suggested that he might not be mentally fit to stand trial. But on Friday, a judge ruled that he was competent to stand trial. Jennifer Barry Hawes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston, and she's currently working on a book about the Emmanuel AME church massacre.
Well, it was a pretty somber start to the court. There had been a number of delays, and I think that a lot of people were unsure if it would actually go forward at this point. There were, behind the prosecutor's table, about 3 rows of the victim's family members, 2 of the shooting survivors, the church's pastor, and a number of other people who had gathered to pay very close attention to what was going on. Dylann Roof came in a jail jumpsuit, which is unusual because normally during jury selection, the defendant would wear street clothes. So I think that put everybody a little bit on edge as to what was going to move forward.
So now that Dylann Roof's competency to stand trial has been decided by the judge, he now says that he wants to defend himself.
That's right. That's right. Jury selection was briefly postponed just for a few minutes because the judge received a request late Sunday from the defense team that Roof wanted to represent himself. So they went through a series of standard questions to determine if he was capable of doing that and going through his constitutional rights to do so. It was a big surprise for a lot of people who thought once the competency issue was resolved that now the trial would move forward in sort of standard fashion. It was a surprise, but also raised some real concerns for them as far as whether justice would be served in this case, because ultimately that's what they want. Nobody wants to go through this trial, but they do want to see Dylann Roof brought to justice and their loved ones' deaths in a way where they can at least try to move forward. I think that having this trial and then the state trial as well hanging over their heads is really creating a stressful situation for a lot of them. And now to have him representing himself, it throws an element of chaos in there when all they want is a fair trial.
Now, you've been spending a lot of time with these family members over this last year and a half, and I wonder if you can give a sense of the process that some of them have been going through. Obviously, the grieving and the pain, but getting to this point where they might feel like they're on the cusp of some form of justice. I don't know if you call it potential closure or what they're going through.
It's been a real up and down for a lot of them because obviously there's just the tremendous amount of grief. particularly for the survivors. There's just all of the trauma involved and what they have to deal with as far as the images that recur in their minds and the loss of all of those people. But it's compounded by the fact that a lot of them had a sense that the church's leadership did not reach out and support them the way they felt ministerial staff should have done. Felicia Sanders and Polly Shepherd, the two women who were in the fellowship hall at the time who survived the shooting, both have spoken to me about how the church's pastor at the time, not the current pastor, did not come by their homes, did not reach out to them. In Felicia's case, stood her up for some meetings that she had hoped to have with the interim pastor. It all forced them into a situation of feeling that they not only had lost their loved ones, but they also had lost their church in some ways. It's made them victims twice in a way, certainly not the same way, but nonetheless in another way. And the new pastor has really made some efforts to reach out to the family members and the survivors and try to heal some of those wounds.
What have the family members said to you about their feelings about the death penalty, its appropriateness in this case, and whether they want it to apply to Dylann Roof?
The family members are, I would say, a majority of them, of the ones that I've spoken to about this, do not favor the death penalty on religious grounds. There are several who adamantly oppose it and don't want to go through this trial at all. There are a few who have described for me their personal religious views of the death penalty, but their sentiment that the criminal justice system needs to handle criminal justice. And so if the ultimate penalty for a crime this horrific is the death penalty, then they will support that. And then there's another group, a smaller group, that is very strongly in favor of the death penalty. They have made that very clear and believe that this crime of any deserves it. So they are not a monolith. There's sometimes a portrayal of them as if they are all of like mind. And these are very different people who live in different parts of the country. Many of them have connections to Emmanuel, but some do not. They're very different in their thinking. I would say there's a general or majority view that the death penalty is not something the Bible supports. But as I said, that is certainly not the only view.
So two trials back to back. What is the estimated timeline here before verdicts are finally rendered?
And that's the magic question at this point. It looks like the federal trials jury selection process likely will go bump up against the winter holiday. They'll break, come back. And at that point, we're looking at, by the attorney's estimates, perhaps 2 months of testimony. And then, of course, jury deliberations. There's, of course, 2 separate parts of this. You'll have the guilt phase, then a short break, and then the penalty phase when the jury will decide Dylann Roof's ultimate fate. And then the state death penalty trial is scheduled at this point to begin in mid-January. Obviously, that's probably not going to happen because testimony will be continuing in the federal trial. There's some question remaining. If Dylann Roof gets the death penalty in federal court, will the state prosecutor continue to pursue the death penalty in state court or not? That's all something that will have to be addressed as we get a little further along. But if we do a state death penalty trial, then we'll be looking again at another couple of months of trial potentially. And I know for some of the family members I've spoken to, that just is a very, very difficult thing to stomach. But it's been a really up and down battle for them, and promises to continue to be so for at least the next couple of months, perhaps longer.
The federal trial of Dylann Roof in the shooting at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is underway as families stand by and look for some justice in that case. Jennifer Berry Hawes, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jennifer Berry Hawes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston. The 2016 World Chess Championship is coming down to its final game on Wednesday between number one defending champion Magnus Carlsen of Norway and Sergei Kryokin of Russia. There have been 12 matches so far, neck and neck, most of them ending in draws. Now, these two players are both in their mid-20s. They're the youngest to meet for the World Championship, and this could be a sign of a new age in chess on the world stage. To help us make sense of all of this, chess grandmaster and author Maurice Ashley joins us. Maurice, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. So help us out. Describe these two players a bit. What are they about in the arena? Magnus Carlsen is the world number one. He's the favorite, of course. Sergei Karjakin of Russia is the challenger upstart. But what do they bring here?
Well, Magnus, he's been the world champion already for going on 5 years. He's the pretty boy. He's a G-star, raw model. Everybody loves him. And everybody expected him to win this championship quite easily. Sergei Karjakin, on the other hand, he's the youngest grandmaster of all time. Magnus and he were grandmasters in their teenage years, but Sergei one-upped him by becoming a grandmaster at age 12. He's been in Magnus's shadow for a long time, but this has been his coming out party. And as a tremendous defender, he's proven that he's nobody easy to beat.
So both of these players are young. They came up, though, in the age of high-powered AI and computer chess. That means something important in the chess world.
Absolutely. Chess nowadays with AI, the computers can show an idea to be good or bad instantly. So you get to play it one time, surprise opponents, and that's it. So it's an era of a lot of analysis. People are worried about their computers being hacked. There's a story about Magnus worrying that maybe the Russians would be hacking his computer to get some of the intel that he has in there that he planned to spring on Karjakin.
One thing that's interesting here also is that a lot of the spectating is done by computers and AI chess machines. You kind of follow and analyze the match. I've noticed as I've been reading up on this that a lot of the pre-analysis of the match is done by spectator machines.
Nowadays, the fans, the public, think they know more than the players. And in some cases, they actually do. When the players are in the middle of a game, you have engines running all over the world, all the top engines, and showing the analysis saying the best move is this. And everybody's waiting to see whether or not the players find that computer move. And if they don't, then all of a sudden people are railing, oh, they're not that good. But the truth is, none of us could find those moves either under the intense pressure.
So these two young, phenomenal players have had 12 matches, right? I mean, draw after draw after draw, a couple of wins in there. What's been going on the board between them, if you can describe it for us lay people? And what needs to happen for one of these guys to really come out on top here?
The reality is that Sergei has been a complete defensive machine. I mean, a steel curtain. He's put it all up and said, no, you're not going to come beat me. It looks like he's not even trying to win the games. He's just trying to prove to Magnus that he can't beat him. After 12 games, the match is tied. It now goes to the most exciting form of chess that we all love to see, and that's rapid chess. Rapid chess, the games end in less than an hour. That is 25 minutes per side instead of these six-hour drawn-out affairs. So each game is going to be four rapid games. And if it's tied after that, then it goes down to quicker time controls, down to blitz, five-minute chess. That's really fast. So this will be the first world championship ever decided at a quick time control. So the games are on Wednesday, and it's going to be a ton of fun to watch. The commentators will have trouble just keeping up with how fast the moves are coming.
This rapid blitz chess, this sounds like kind of the couple of seconds per move, the kind of clocked chess I see guys playing in the park sometimes.
Exactly. It's the most fun. But in fact, this is where the spectators really have a lot of fun. The purists don't like it because there are going to be mistakes. You can't play the perfect moves that will go down in history. But this is where most of the fun is, that the more and more rapid events we're seeing that the spectators really want. To see a world championship decided this way, most people won't be happy. But personally, I think it's a lot of fun.
After all these 12 matches and all these draws and rapid blitz chess coming up, who's going to win it?
Well, Sergei Karjakin has proven himself to be a worthy challenger, no question about it. But Magnus Carlsen, not only is he the world champion, he also happens to be the back-to-back world rapid champion. So, you know, it doesn't take a genius to say that Magnus should come out on top.
The 2016 World Chess Championships coming down to the final game. Rapid fire chess, blitz chess is coming up in the final match tomorrow. 10 draws so far. It's down to the wire. Maurice Ashley, chess grandmaster and author. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.